Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 30th, and the first order of business, as always, is to take the roll. Ms. Niederhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Bierman, present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damuth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grünhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz. Schultz. Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niederhofer. So the next order of business is to approve the minutes. We have two sets. And the first is from March 25th, 2022. Representative Wolgamott.
Madam Chair, I would like to move approval of the minutes for March 25th, 2022.
All right, thank you. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 25th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
We have the auto theft prevention.
The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 25th are approved. And then the second set, March 28th, Representative Wolgamott.
Madam Chair, I reviewed those also and would like to move approval of the minutes for March 28th, 2022.
All right. Thank you so much. So the minutes are before us. Is there any discussion? Representative Schultz.
Thank you. I just want to note that I am present. I'm presenting the bill in commerce. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I thought you had a comment to the minutes. Okay. So scared me there for a minute. Okay. Any discussion to the minutes of March 28th? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes of March 28th are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Wolgamott. So the first bill on our agenda today is House File 3898. We have Representative Jordan back before us, and thank you for being here, Representative Jordan. So the chair will move that House File 3898 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. And so thank you for being back here with more lead bills, Representative Jordan. It's been the year for that, for sure. And please go ahead and tell us about this one.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to the committee for hearing another lead bill and making this such a great priority this year in the Health Committee. I will be quick because I have a really great testifier with me who I know you'd rather listen to. And I also know that you all know that no amount of exposure to lead is safe. House File 3899 modifies the definition of elevated blood level to 3.5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of whole blood. Current statute sets it at 10 micrograms per deciliter, and in 2014, our health commissioner determined that 5 micrograms per deciliter is an appropriate measure of elevated blood, lead content in blood. The CDC has set 3.5 micrograms per deciliter as an elevated blood level of lead for children who are also the most vulnerable to lead poisoning. By adjusting this definition of an elevated blood level, the state will be able to provide remediation services to more children and families who are experiencing the adverse effects of lead exposure. Remember, members, no amount of lead is safe. Now, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn over testimony and presentation to Dr. Zeke McKinney from the University of Minnesota.
Great. Thank you very much. Dr. McKinney, welcome to the committee. If you would just state your own name and tell us who you're with and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, ma'am. Hello, my name is Zeke McKinney. I am the Program Director of Health Partners Occupational and Environmental Medicine Residency. I'm an affiliate assistant professor for the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, a research investigator for Health Partners Institute, as well as the president of Twin Cities Medical Society. I wanted to start off by concurring with what what Representative Jordan said, that no lead level is safe for humans, children, or adults, though children are, in fact, more vulnerable. The CDC did update their elevated reference blood lead level for children to 3.5 micrograms per deciliter as of October 2021. That was down from previously 5. The adult blood lead reference level is, in fact, 10 micrograms per deciliter. What's interesting is in Minnesota statutes 144.9501, it's defined that elevated lead level for all people, I guess, is 10 micrograms per deciliter, which is evidently too high. As an annotation in that same statute, it is mentioned that the health commissioner has specified that 5 is an elevated level. Overall, you know, the spirit of public health is to ultimately protect those who are most vulnerable, and in this case, that would be children, and therefore, I am strongly in support of defining in that statute that an elevated level for all people, for our purposes here in Minnesota, would be 3.5 micrograms per deciliter. Just to reiterate what I had said in previous testimony, lead is primarily a neurotoxin, so it can cause very deleterious effects to kids, especially in the developing phases, particularly to infants and fetuses. This can also be problematic for adults and can have long-term effects on people's success outcomes in life, their ability to thrive. However, lead can also have many other effects, including on the bones, the liver, the gastrointestinal tract, as well as many other body systems. Deposition of lead occurs throughout life and will store in bones, so this is very important, and ultimately I support this keeping us to 3.5 milligrams per deciliter. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. McKinney. So with that, we will go to member questions and discussion. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. I don't know if this would be for the testifier, for the author, the first question. But by reducing this number, do we heighten any regular...
Oops, we lost you there,
Representative Backer. Let's do that again. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. By reducing this number, do we heighten any regulations, or is this more just for serving for lower levels, just keep an eye for the lower levels? So does this enhance regulations? What happens when we redefine this? That would be my first question, Madam Chair.
All right. I think that's a great question. What are the implications of making this change on what, as you said, regulations or the activities of the health department? Representative Jordan, did you want to take a crack at that first?
I can take a crack at it, Madam Chair, and thank you for acknowledging me. I also know that there are members from MDH who could also specify, but essentially when we do regular testing for blood lead level, I challenge you to all say that 10 times fast, blood lead level, we do testing and monitoring of children. And if a child has what is considered an elevated blood level, so in this case, should this become law, it would be 3.5 micrograms per deciliter. And let me know if you need me to define microgram or deciliter. But if that would be the new elevated blood level, and then the health department, and in some cases it's the state, some cases it's Hennepin County or the city of Minneapolis or Ramsey County, they would come in and provide their services to that family and to those individuals with that elevated blood level. They go through homes and say, oh, you have this paint here that could be causing this. You have an issue with your plumbing here. You have old implements, and these could be all the areas where remediation is needed to make sure that your home is a safe environment for your family. And I do know that the health department could probably expand on that far better than I could, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Testifier from, or our question answerer from MDH, please go ahead, introduce yourself, and go ahead, answer the question.
Hi, this is Dr. Stephanie Yendel from the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you, Chair Representative Jordan. I am the supervisor of the Health Risk Intervention Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. So we receive all of those elevated blood lead levels. So as Representative Jordan mentioned, yes, we do receive all of the blood lead levels for children in Minnesota. For any child with an elevated blood lead level, the specific actions are outlined. It's So the definition is given in 144.9501, and then the follow-up actions are defined in Minnesota Statutes 144.9504 for secondary prevention. And so the way that 9504 is written, starting at 5 micrograms per deciliter is when the jurisdictions are required to go into households. However, it does give the authority if there are resources to go into the house of any child with an elevated level. And so what changing the definition in 9501 would do is provide that additional authority if there are resources to be able to go in and do that full environmental assessment, but it would not change the requirement to do so. And so just a point of clarification that in the fiscal note on the MDH side, we did not include the cost for doing those additional environmental investigations because that would not change the requirement to do so under 9504, the way that the bill is written.
Okay, thank you. Representative Backer, any follow-up?
Not on that one, I have another question.
Oh, go ahead, please.
My second question is, and this is to the author, of course. I've heard lead bills in environment, which we appreciate. And of course, the author shared this at the beginning that there's no safe level. Why are we not setting it at zero then?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Backer. I would love that. I know Representative Lee actually has a bill to do so. I think it's not entirely feasible to do it at zero. I would love to work with you and Representative Lee and everyone else to see if we could get to that. This is one that I took from that CDC guidance for elevated blood lead level from the CDC of 3.5. But if you want to work on getting it to zero, I'd appreciate that. I also know that Dr. McKinney has further information on this, the medical practicality of that, if you would be interested in hearing that.
Yeah, let's hear from Dr. McKinney on that. Dr. McKinney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representatives Jordan and Backer. Yeah, so as Representative Jordan pointed out, it may be both logistically and fiscally infeasible to set a level of zero. As these levels have continued to go down over time, that is what is defined as an elevated level by CDC or state public health departments, we are seeing decreases in population averages. All of these data are collected actually nationally through what's called NHANES. It's a national survey of information, including some biomarker data, including lead levels. And they do this every year or two and release the data, and it's all online and it's available. Right now, we see that 3.5 milligrams per deciliter is actually above the 95th percentile for the population or on all age groups and particularly in young kiddos. So setting it at that level right now is not really unreasonable relative to what we know, because we know the people who are above that level are the most highly exposed. The reason that this isn't feasible, and this speaks to what Dr. Yendell mentioned, was that, you know, trying to remove lead paint from all homes, lead from all pipes, lead from all other sources, including, you know, bullets, which was raised at a different testimony a month or so ago, is, again, logistically impractical without changing a whole large number of laws and a whole large number of environmental sources that we can't completely contain right now. So from a medical perspective, trying to monitor everybody above zero would really basically just set off red flags all over the place and ultimately be a logistical and financial nightmare probably for the state and the health department. And so I think it's more feasible in the spirit of public health to continue to over time reduce these levels in the way that we have been. And what Representative Jordan is proposing is really simply following national guidance.
So if I could just follow up with that for a moment, Dr. McKinney and Representative Jordan. As I'm understanding it, we're this changing this to this level as you're proposing, this doesn't say that that's a safe level. What this does is it really prioritizes prioritizes where we bring the resources to try to mitigate the harm. Is that kind of an accurate way to say it, Dr. McKinney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, in fact, by reducing this level, that would increase the number of children who can be positively affected by interventions from the state health department as described by Dr. Yendell. And that is exactly the intention of this, that it provides the legislative and or public health authority to do so in cases where it would be most useful. And for children, because the long-term effects are going to be the most pronounced, those are the ones who are the most vulnerable and who we want to protect the most.
All right, thank you. Representative Backer, if you're done, I'll go to
the next. I am done, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pryor.
Well, first, I do have to say thank you to Tara Liebling and our bill author and testifiers for clarifying that last point about setting priorities for this remediation that we have to do. And I would like to maybe take this time to also make sure that I'm understanding more about lead, especially as it affects children, and using this opportunity for education too in general, knowing that this is an issue, as we've heard, many bills that have been trying to address this in the most powerful way that we can, but also setting priorities within what we have the ability to do. So just so I understand better, there's children now that are being exposed to lead. I know a lot from the environment, paint being a huge part of it. So once they're at that level, like of 3.5 or above, when the source of the poisoning is removed, do the levels go down?
Would that be for Dr. McKinney, maybe?
Yeah, I think so, Dr. McKinney. Thank you.
Yeah, Dr. McKinney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Pryor. Yes, that is correct. When the source of lead is removed, the body will naturally clear lead over time, and so the expectation is that children's levels will reduce. Without getting too much into the deep science, that clearance can vary from person to person and with medical conditions, but generally speaking, yes, once the primary source has been identified and removed, levels will continue to reduce.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for that answer, Dr. McKinney, because I also remember from previous testimony, probably on a different bill, that once the damage has been done, it can't be reversed in a child. And so I can see making it even more the urgency and also our ability to take these really positive steps to stop the damage that might be done to young children in particular by as fast as possible getting this remediation out. Among the many, many lead bills that we've heard, obviously this is another really, really important one. And I just want to also understand the bill of what we can do here and what this particular piece of legislation is doing. We're just changing the definitions of, these levels, but not actually, and the fiscal note is about being able to do the investigations, but that this particular bill is not addressing getting more funding to correct the actual problems.
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, that is correct.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Just for the record, when she was talking about that once the damage is done, heads were nodding, yes, that's correct. So I just want to make sure everyone, because not everyone is seeing all of your faces at the same time. Okay, I will go to Representative Grünhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this would be for Representative Jordan. Okay, so once they have this information, do they inform the person that's affected, or what is done with the information as far as the lead level?
Representative Jordan?
Madam Chair, yes, we inform people if they have an elevated blood level content in their blood. Dr. Yendel from MDH could talk more about the notification process if you want to go down into those details.
Dr. Yendel?
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative Jordan. So Representative Grünhagen, the general process is that once the Minnesota Department of Health receives those elevated blood lead levels, we notify the local health department for the jurisdiction that person is in. Often that's a county, but sometimes it's multiple counties put together. And then that local health department contact the family, they provide them with educational information on how common sources of lead exposure, things that they can do that are good general advice, reminders to go in and get retested. There's some subtleties here with blood lead testing where often there is a capillary test that is done first, that's considered a screening test, and we need to follow that up with a more diagnostic venous test. And so the local health department can walk through families, making sure that they get that follow-up testing, and then making sure that their levels go down. And then if the blood lead level is elevated enough that someone is going to be going out and doing an environmental assessment, which right now in statute, that's 5 micrograms per deciliter, then the local health department is often also present during that inspection, but it would be someone from either Minnesota Department of Health, City of Minneapolis, or Ramsey County that does those in-home environmental assessments.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. I just was wondering what they did with the information, so thanks for that response.
All right, thank you. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not sure if this is for the author or maybe for the doctor. Excuse me. Can I get my camera
going? We have two doctors on, Representative Ackland. So.
Dr. McKinney, was it McKinney?
Yeah.
Anyway, my question is, are there state guidelines for testing all children for blood lead levels? And if so, at what age? And or are these levels detected as a result of an illness that the child has presented with? And as part of the investigation into the reason for the illness, these are detected on an individual basis based on an illness.
So Dr. McKinney, if you have that, you go ahead and answer. Otherwise, that might actually be better for Dr. Yandel, but please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ackland. And Dr. Yandel can, I think, comment a little bit better on the surveillance of children. But essentially, it is all children under age 2 are screened at least once for an elevated blood lead level as part of their normal childhood screening. And then if it's in fact elevated, they will be tested again. And this happens as part of their normal well child visits in the first 2 years of life. In general, it would not be tested as part of illness unless lead exposure was thought to be the source of the illness. But in general, that's very relatively uncommon.
Thank you. So under the age of 2, do they try to get it like closer to 2 when more exposure has occurred? I mean, I just wonder, there's a big difference there between 0 to 2, how you might catch an elevated blood level.
Dr. McKinney?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Ackland. Yes, you're correct. There is a difference in how kids would be exposed from ages 0 to 2, which is why the screening actually does happen, I believe, at once under age 1 and once under age 2. So usually twice. But ultimately, the intent is to determine what households may be most at risk for elevated exposures. As I've spoken about in prior testimony, this is an issue of equity where our lower income households, primarily also households of color, households that fall within, you know, higher dimensions of the CDC's social vulnerability index are going to be more likely to be exposed. And of course, this is yet one more social determinant that may impact the outcomes for children going forward. But ultimately, the point is, yes, there is differential degrees of exposure as toddlers, for example, start walking and peeling paint chips and eating them versus kids who are drinking water or formula. For example, or playing in the dirt at various ages.
Representative Ackland?
Thank you. That answers my question.
All right. Very good. Okay. I also have a question, and I don't know if this would be for Dr. Yandel. I think you're about to turn off your camera. Hold on a second. So my understanding is that lead exposure and high elevated lead can, we've talked about low socioeconomic, but this is a problem of every group. Am I wrong about that? I mean, it seems to me that oftentimes we don't know when there's lead in the environment and anybody can be exposed. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So yes, we do see certainly higher levels of exposure among children with a higher socio vulnerability index. So especially older houses that have deferred maintenance, for example, we see problems sometimes with rental housing that hasn't had the same level of turnover of some of the housing components that other homes have had. And so you still have more of that original lead-based paint that's there. However, we certainly see lead exposure among all income levels. We see it, for example, among families that have purchased a home. Maybe it's an older home and they decide to do some of their own renovations, and that causes lead dust to be kicked up. We also see exposure from other sources. So among folks that bring spices, particularly from India and Bangladesh, we have seen a lot of spices that were purchased in other countries, brought back from relatives or from trips, and then that is causing exposure now in the family now that they're back in Minnesota. So yes, we certainly see exposure from a wide variety of sources, but as Dr. McKinney said, it is also a question of social vulnerability and the amount of agency that families have to control some of their exposures in their own housing.
All right, thank you. And Dr. McKinney, and then we'll finish up with Representative Jordan, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add to Dr. Yendel's point. We also have industrial sources. There was a concern, for example, of Northern Metals recycling on the west side of the Mississippi River between just on the edge of North Minneapolis and Northeast Minneapolis, with some increased lead levels in the air nearby there, which could have been from other industrial sources as well. And additionally, we've seen para-occupational exposures, that is, exposures brought to the home from somebody working in an occupation, most famously recently with water gremlin and elevated lead levels in the children associated there. So to exactly your point, it does occur in all walks of life, but tends to be worse, especially, for example, people who live in areas where industrial contamination can be an issue, of course, too.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Jordan, final word?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. McKinney. Thank you, Dr. Yendel. Thank you to the committee for this really great discussion. I think we all learned a lot, and I thought this was a pretty productive discussion. And so I'm hoping you will consider this as part of your omnibus bill and support reducing the elevated blood lead level going forward. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Don't go anywhere. So House File 3898 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And now we will take up your other bill, House File 4115, and this one, the chair is going to move that House File 4115 be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. And and let me add my thanks to Dr. McKinney and Dr. Yendel before we move on here. Thank you very much for your assistance and good testimony. Anyway, so the bill is before us, House File 4115. And there is an author's amendment to the bill, and that is in your packets, members. So the chair will move the DE1-1 author's amendment. And Representative Jordan, since it is an author's amendment, maybe you could just give us, why don't you speak to the amendment before we adopt it? Just tell us what it does that's different.
Sure, Madam Chair. And thank you for moving my bill and the amendment. This is based on feedback that we received from both PFA, the Department of Health, and various municipalities on how to make the previous iteration of the bill work. It makes a number of changes, but it's more cleaned up language. There is still some cleaning up that we're going to have to do on appropriation bonds, but I've spoken to Chair Lee, and he is going to take a look at that and help me when it gets to its next committee stop.
All right, very good. So the DE1-1 is before us. So all in favor of adoption of the DE1-1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the DE1-1 amendment is adopted. So Representative Jordan, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm excited to present House File 4115 to you, which is a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through lead service lines. As you all know, at least I hope by now, lead service lines are one of the largest lead sources in Minnesota's drinking water, and often these lead service lines are both publicly and privately owned. As you know, we must replace both parts simultaneously to avoid increasing lead concentration in drinking water. I'm sure you all remember when I presented House File 2650 last winter. I believe there was snow on the ground then too. And this bill has incorporated feedback I received from all of you on that bill and feedback from other committees that we presented the bill in. Thank you, Representative Backer. We also incorporate ideas from other levels of government and our state agencies and input from clean water advocates across the state. As you know, lead exposure through drinking water is a statewide issue, and these lead service lines are present across Minnesota in all communities, urban, suburban, and rural. No amount of exposure to lead is safe. And here's what House File 4115 does. It creates a state grant program for lead line removal administered by the Department of Health, funded at $30 million a year for 10 years. Municipalities and community water systems are eligible for grants to remove and replace these lines. The money can also be used to repay loans for the same purposes. At least 70% of the funds must be used to remove the privately owned portions of lead lines. It prioritizes city water systems that have a plan to remove all lead lines and have identified how they will maximize participation from homeowners. Large systems must also develop a workforce plan to promote and expand the use of apprentices and those underrepresented in the construction industry. It creates a goal to remove all lead lines by 2032, and it creates a separate grant program funded at $10 million to provide support for municipalities in producing an inventory and mapping the location of these lead service lines. As I said earlier, I told you we were waiting for some guidance from the EPA. They recently finalized that update to their lead and copper rule, which requires water systems to produce this inventory by October 16th, 2024, along with their plan to remove these lead service lines. This also bill requires that same inventory and plan also be submitted to MDH, and would require MDH to publish that inventory and plan. It also requires water systems to notify MDH when lead levels in their water exceed 10 micrograms per liter, although if we pass my previous bill, we might want to change that, and how they will comply with federal requirements. With that, Madam Chair, I know we have a number of testifiers on this bill, and I would like to turn over my time to them.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Jordan. So we have Myron Kowetz.
That is correct.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Myron Coates. I'm the mayor of the city of Pipestone. And to really make sense of this whole presentation, I have to go back to when we were founded, which was in 1870s, as most of the prairie cities out in southwest Minnesota. The number of buildings, that is the most structures that were built in the community, were built between the 1900s and 1960. This is significant, as the city did not have a building code, or did we have building officials during that time frame. So we really don't know what's out there in some cases. We're not sure the service lines for business or homeowners, lead, copper, galvanized, plastic, or otherwise. And the only way that we have found out is through major street projects and where the supervising engineer has inspected them and recorded them, which I personally worked on a particular project in the 1990s, and we did not record the lead service lines that we uncovered at that time. So that's where we have to go back. The area of the city that we're talking about in the town of 4300 is about 160 square blocks. And the only way that we can get to find out where these lead service lines are is actually go out and inspect. My wastewater supervisor said that he has estimated there's about 125 to 300 of these service lines in that area. And the ones that we cannot inspect in a basement in the on the incoming line, if we can't determine that, we will have to go out into the yard and actually dig down to the service line to figure out what the composite of the material is. We plan on replacing service lines, or preliminary planning on two different ways. One is through reconstruction of roads when we replace infrastructure such as water, sewer, and so forth. It's an excellent time to replace them at that time. However, to meet the 2032 deadline, we will have to come up with a plan to actually go to homeowners individually and essentially encourage them or to work with them to replace the known lines that we have. And we're talking about the older homes in Pipestone and how this relates very well to some of your conversations that you've been having, is that this is primarily your lower cost homes. These are populated largely by what I would call workforce families, which is typically the highest in your childbearing years, or by senior citizens. That is not entirely all the case, but the majority are that way, And I'd just like to kind of end my testimony by actually relating a conversation I had with a person that I was walking through the neighborhood where I know there's lead lines. And it was kind of interesting, the individual that I was talking to, I hadn't seen him all winter. And so I was asking where he was and kind of getting updated on his life. And what he did is he told me that his wife had passed away last October. And what is significant about that, this was not the first marriage for both of them. And they essentially got married, but they didn't have the financial capability to actually have a home. So there's what the stepson is the one that signed the mortgage. They were making the payments. And so then I had the opportunity to explain to him what the lead service line program would look like. And if he had to pay $3,000, which we're estimating the cost per line to replace, well, how would that affect him? And basically he looked down at his shoes and told me, I don't think I could afford the home at that point. And so it's not all the residents in this area are affected the same, but there'd be more stories like this, and more stories about rental properties. And it is going to be a hardship for some and not for others. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much for testimony. Okay, Mr. Thorson, John Thorson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm Legislative Director for LIUNA Minnesota and North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, highways, bridges, and the basic utilities that allow our communities to thrive. We're proud to stand with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, Conservation Minnesota, the Operating Engineers Local 49, and the Associated General Contractors in seeking a transformational investment in our state's future that'll put us on a path for removing the estimated 100,000 to 260,000 lead lines that threaten our drinking water today. We strongly support the provisions of House File 4115 that call for eliminating all lead service lines in our state by 2032, and that provide the direct grant funding necessary to ensure that cities can map, identify, and replace both the lead pipes in the public right-of-way and the 70% of service lines on private property. It's estimated removal and replacement of lead service pipes will create and maintain around 2,400 jobs annually in Minnesota for the next 10 years. LIUNA members are skilled in lead service line replacement and have worked with cities all throughout the state to accelerate the identification and removal of these dangerous lead pipes in our communities. The prevailing wage requirements in this bill are important, and they are there to guarantee family-supporting wages for local skilled construction workers on projects funded or financed with taxpayer dollars. Prevailing wage laws ensure construction workers earn a fair wage, and they lead to safer, higher quality work and stability for local economies. The socioeconomic impacts of a job that pays middle-class wages provides comprehensive family health care and retirement benefits and offers opportunities for training and career advancement can exceed those created by a relatively low wage, no benefit job by a factor of five or more. Registered apprenticeship programs like ours are critical efforts to increase participation of women, people of color, veterans, and other underrepresented groups into lifelong careers in construction. And Madam Chair, I want to thank Representative Jordan for bringing this proposal forward, and encourage members of the committee to support House File 4115 and these critical state investments, which will ensure that lead pipes are replaced, clean drinking water is delivered to families and children across Minnesota, and it'll increase the health, social, and economic vitality of our entire state. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thorson. Next, we have Steve Morse. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me a couple minutes to share some thoughts here. My name is Steve Morse. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and we're the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation groups with membership from across the entire state. I have 3 points to make. Number one, thank you, Representative Jordan, for picking this issue up and being such a good promoter of it. Representative Jordan initially introduced this bill last year and laid out this idea of a 10-year timeframe to go through and clean up and replace all of these lead pipelines. We're very happy to see that discussion start a year ago, and we worked with her on that process. Now we've seen federal activities, which has elevated the discussion and also provided more funding for this process. And now what that does is it means the state's imperative to move forward and make this change actually happen makes it much more doable. So thank you, Representative Jordan, for your consistent work, and also the chair for moving this bill forward. Secondly, I just want to underscore how it's been a priority for our MEP community for a number of years. Working in Duluth, we actually did testing of lead lines, and some of you heard this testimony earlier, but we tested 52 homes with community people, and 19% of the homes that were tested had levels above the EPA actionable level of 10 parts per billion. So it's a very much a very real problem. We did then provide water treatment to those homes that we identified, water filtration, rather, to those homes that we identified. Lastly, I would just like to say this is also a priority for our entire community. We believe that we need to protect the drinking water, the groundwater, the lakes, and we need to protect that water all the way up to the point where people drink it. Lake Superior might have great water, but it's not so great if by the time people drink it, it's contaminated with lead. There are three really important things that we feel strongly about in this bill. The whole bill is great, but we like the 100% replacement, so we're going to do all of them. We're going to do them in a 10-year timeframe, and we're going to do it without costs to households so that those communities and those homeowners that are most impacted and have suffered the greatest burden of toxics in their environment will have this done over a certain timeframe. I would just ask for the committee support and move this on to capital investment and stand for any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Scott Anderson. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Anderson. I'm the utility superintendent for the city of Bloomington. I'm also the chair of the Water Utility Council for the Minnesota section of the American Water Works Association. The Water Utility Council is a working group of water utility representatives from throughout the state, along with consulting and commercial members and state agency representation as well, including the League of Minnesota Cities. We work on issues of statewide significance to public water suppliers. I'd like to first thank the bill authors for the DE1 amendment. I've been happy to work with the League over the past couple of weeks working on some language on a previous bill, and this new bill and amendment addresses many of those concerns. I think overall, from the perspective of a water supplier and the Water Utility Council, this bill is going in the right direction relative to the EPA rule and requirements that we're subject to and pertaining to continuing to provide safe and reliable drinking water in an equitable fashion to the public. I would like to point out one remaining concern or challenge. It's not unique to this bill. It's as Representative Jordan pointed out, with guidance coming out from the EPA being finalized just kind of in the moment, there are a couple of items in this bill that lead to some questions, specifically Section 3, Subpart 2, you know, reference to the lead service line reduction plan, kind of an ambiguity into what that might consist of, as well as the inventory itself and what ultimately would be what will be an acceptable inventory leads to questions for utilities in terms of you know, what documentation is required, what type of level of effort do we need. What would be acceptable so we know we can confidently move forward with this. That sums up my main concern with regard to this bill. I would like to thank the committee, and I definitely appreciate the resources that this bill makes available to water utilities. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer those.
All right, well, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. And then finally on this list, I have Craig Johnson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I am with the League of Minnesota Cities,
Since we don't get to come in front of this committee very often, I'll just give a brief background that League of Minnesota Cities represents essentially all the cities of the state. There are 854 cities in Minnesota, 837 of them are members of the League of Minnesota Cities. And the ones that are not members have populations under 200, and we still answer the phone if they call. We would also like to start by thanking the author very much for putting a considerable amount of work into understanding where we were having concerns and issues with previous language that's been worked on in this regard. Minnesota cities and public water utilities in the state spend tens of millions of dollars every year to make sure that citizens and businesses have clean, reliable, and affordable supplies of water to use for their homes and their businesses and other purposes. And so have been working on this issue for a very long time with the Department of Health, with EPA, and with the other state agencies that overlap in dealing with how we handle water in the state. And this bill does address the vast majority of things that we were talking about with the author as far as concerns with previous language. So we do not see a reason to hold back on moving forward with this plan. We do appreciate that there's an awareness that there are some vaguenesses in this that still need to be worked out. The federal government has not issued its final guidance yet on what we have to do as far as plans, either for inventories or for replacement plans, both of which are federally required. And so because of that, we are still working with Department of Health to put together what their guidance will be and what resources they will be able to make available for communities as they take this on. Because as you can guess, every community has completely different situations as far as what parts and what percentage of their community are exposed and how they will do it. A thing to keep in mind as you look at these lead service line issues is the public rights of way we do have access to, and we can work on the lead service lines there. They tend to involve tearing up streets, so it gets very expensive to do that portion of the work. The non-public part, the part that's on private property, has several challenges. One, it limits what sources of money you can use to do it. And two, we cannot set foot on that property as city officials without the permission of the property owner. So we can't just walk onto your property and inspect your line and tell you what it's made out of. We have to work individually with each property owner to do that. And we certainly cannot replace any property, you know, any lines on your property without the property owner agreeing to do that. So this is going to be a slow process. And we think that there is going to be a lot of challenges. And we think this bill provides resources that will help us in meeting those. So thank you very much for the time and attention. And we will happily keep working with the author on and other authors on this as the idea moves forward, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. So those are all the testifiers we have. Are there any questions from members? I'm not seeing any. And just want to say, Representative Jordan, obviously from listening to the testifiers, and this is a complicated bill, and just thank you so much for all your work on this, because obviously getting all these different groups to be comfortable with the direction you're going is no easy feat. So really appreciate that. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was curious how this would interact with current programs out there. Many of the small cities are competing for grants and money for updating their water systems. And how would this interact with them?
Representative Jordan, if you want to call on one of your other testifiers, you might have one here who could answer.
Maybe. I would also, I don't, thank you, Madam Chair. I could perhaps take a crack at it if Representative Quam could be a bit more specific, but if there is someone here who would like to answer that who's more used to dealing with some of the competing grant processes, I would welcome your input.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I can take a piece of a shot at that, Representative Quam. So it is not made clear entirely in this bill how that will work in practice. It says that the funding would go out in cooperation with the Public Facilities Authority and with the intent of maximizing the resources they have available. And so I think the what would have to be worked out is how do we tie the application to this process to the one-stop shop that the public facilities already does. So if a small community comes in right now to public facilities and says, we need money for a project, they don't need to know which pot of public facilities money they're eligible for. They just apply, and the PFA would help them get the right amount of money from the pot of money that they are eligible for. I think what we would need to work out with PFA is how they would add these new pots of money to that mix so that they were referring people to those, hopefully through the same kind of process. The challenge is a lot of this is going to be individual property owners needing resources, and they do not have access to the Public Facilities Authority. So the details of how this money goes out are going to need some work as we move forward. But I think the public portion of it that goes to cities will be a little easier to figure out.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. This is obviously a huge issue, and it's not all going to be solved quickly and easily.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, you're probably somewhat familiar with Orinoco, which has multiple projects and things, but the biggest hit to it is the fact that there are within the city multiple individual water systems, and they're trying to tie it all together. And because of the age, income, and et cetera, some of them qualify for the PFA, others don't, and it's complicated. Plus, there's also oftentimes a need for a local component or outside of a grant that's available, or if you're coming for something from state funding and bonding, you need to have a certain percentage of local. But part of the curiosity is if this would facilitate that portion contributed outside of the normal grants and projects available, so that make it easier for a city to handle it. Plus the cities that are bringing in shared water sources from, say, you're annexating a portion, a development that was put in that had a common well supporting two dozen homes. Some of this grant that we're talking about in this bill would probably blend in with that activity, and it'd behoove us to have an organized implementation, because if it's fuzzy and it's not explicitly put out in the bill, it may cause some difficulties. And so, that's what I was trying to find out. And I thought,
all right, thank you,
Mr. Johnson could maybe talk about how that might help.
Right. Yeah, Representative Quam, you know, these are good questions, but they don't really belong here in the Health Committee, and we're not really equipped to deal with them. So I guess I'll turn it over to Representative Jordan. The bill has another stop, at least. I'm sure she'd be glad to talk with you. These are important issues. I don't mean to minimize them, but they're not really health committee issues. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one thing I would say to Representative Quam is, as part of this bill, on lines 2.14 and 2.15, as part of the plans that the cities themselves are going to create, so your city will have its own plan, the city of Argyle and northwestern Minnesota will have a different plan, the city of Finland and northeastern Minnesota will have a plan, and then Minneapolis will have its own plan, will actually detail how they're going to interact with other funds. So it's going to be up to your individual city to also say, and we're going to use this pot of money, and we're going to match the federal funding in the following way, and this is how we're going to serve all of our people. And their plan will be very different from Rochester, which is nearby, I know. And so I think it's one of those things that is really exciting about this bill, in a way, is it does allow each community to say, this is what we're going to do, and this is what works in Pipestone. And it might not be what works in Albert Lea, but that's what works for your city. And so I'm, as part of this bill, I'm hopeful that you can actually use this bill to create your own unique plan, you being your city, and also use it to actually maximize funds from both the feds and from the state and other sources.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Jordan, and thank you to all the testifiers. This has been a pretty unusual discussion for the Health Committee, but appreciate this is an important topic and appreciate it. And knowing that there are some small kinks yet to be worked out, it sounds like, but we are sending the bill to the Capital Investment Committee, which is a whole lot more used to dealing with these kinds of issues, I think, than we are. So very good. So with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4115, as amended, be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Reed Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth.
Aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz. Representative Wolgamott. Representative Wolgamott. There are 17 ayes and 0 nays.
All right, there being 17 ayes and 0 nays, House File 4115 as amended is re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you so much, Representative Jordan, and thank you very much to all the testifiers for the interesting presentation. Okay, we are now going to take up House File 4615, Representative Hewitt. And so Representative Hewitt's motion is that House File 4615 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Hewitt, did you want to move the A22-0396 office amendment?
Madam Chair, I do. It gets the bill in the shape that I need it.
Okay, so that amendment is before us, the A22-0396. So all in favor of adoption of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Hewitt, your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. It's a pretty simple, straight bill, and it surprised me when advocates brought it to me. Basically, once determined eligibility for Medicaid, children would maintain their coverage for a full 12 months. This would result in nearly 16,000 Minnesota children and youth maintaining health coverage per month. This has already been adopted as best practices by 23 states. Continuous eligibility for children allow them to maintain access to quality healthcare, well visits, vaccinations, treatments, and can help address Minnesota's health disparities. I witnessed this personally in the emergency room when I worked there and noticed that there were children coming in, not children, but young adults that were afraid to come into the ER because they knew that they are no longer eligible for Medicaid and had to pay the bill themselves with no means of doing such. We don't want our children to start their adult life like this. And this is a good bill to give them that little boost they need. Today I have with me a testifier from the greater,
Twin Cities United Way.
There we go. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Kristen Rosenberg from the Greater Twin Cities United Way. I'd like to have her come forward and explain.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Rosenberger.
Yes. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. As you mentioned, my name is Kristen Rosenberger, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and External Engagement at Greater Twin Cities United Way. And it's a pleasure to be here today and testify in support of House File 4615. And as many of you know, at Greater Twin Cities United Way, our mission is to unite change makers and advocate for social good, to develop solutions that address the challenges that no one can solve alone. And last year, we touched over 500,000 lives across the 9-county metro area and funded over 100 service organizations and coalitions. Together, we're working to advance pathways toward economic independence for working families from low-wealth households. And addressing the benefits cliff was elevated as a top priority by our nonprofit partners, who see it as a primary barrier to increasing family income and achieving financial stability. And so we see these cliffs occur when benefits are lost due to just a small increase in income, and that results many times in a net loss of income for the family, and that causes them to backslide financially. And so with the growing need and demand for workers, it's important to support pathways towards better jobs, better wages, and increased hours, rather than penalizing people taking advantage of improved employment activities and opportunities. And so House File 4615 would allow working families to seek better employment and higher wages while maintaining critical health benefits for their children. And this would also help reduce our state's health disparities by providing children stable access to health care, well visits, vaccination, medications, and medical treatment. So we know quality health care for children, you know, of course, leads to improved long-term health care, our health outcomes, and higher earnings as working adults. So House File 4615 would reduce barriers and encourage a thriving workforce, a thriving economy, and most importantly, thriving families. So I want to thank Representative Hewitt for his leadership on this bill, and many thanks to the committee members for your time today.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ms. Rosenberger. Members, any questions or discussion? Final word, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, committee, and thank you, Chair, for hearing the bill. It's really a good bill, and it really will help our new young adults get off to the right pathway. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you so much. Thank you. So with that, House File 4615 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So we are done with our agenda for the day. It's nice to get done a little bit early once in a while. I'm afraid though that we're gonna have to schedule a hearing for Friday. We have one for Friday. I believe that the agenda has been sent out. Take a look at that, everyone. And we have quite a bit. I think it could possibly go a little faster than it would look to take a look at it right now, but we'll see when we get there. So thank you, everyone. We stand adjourned.